The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. The Senate passed the bill, and I guess we're just waiting for the governor to sign it, but it seems like it's probably in the back. Oh, yeah, you know what? I was just talking about libraries. We also have Jeffrey Ross here this evening, the Roastmaster General of the United States, is making a pre-Rosh Hashanah appearance. So we thank him for his efforts. Jeff, you want to come on out?
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. Having a hand for my nephew. This is awesome. Thank you for coming, everybody. This is cool. We got a... Come on in, lady. We were worried sick about you. These two people sneaking in. Ma'am, do you have a ticket? All right. We were worried sick about you. Where the hell were you? Now, this is cool. This is good practice for me because I'm actually booked in an empty room tomorrow night. I wanted to get my timing together on... You really bought Dan Brown's book, didn't you? That is so funny. You want me to sign Dan Brown's fucking book, don't you? Boy, I know, boy. That is really cute of you. He sold 1 million copies today. Yes. I sold 15,000, and that was when I was a cashier at Barnes & Noble. So are you reading the book right in front of me? Can't you even wait till you have to go home and take a dump or something? The book takes about 4 dumps to get through. No, the Dan Brown book, that looks like a lot of fun. You can enjoy that. If you want to read it while I wheel you home later, that's fine. So are you putting this on the internet? Why are you sitting in the front row videotaping me on your phone? Did I see you on To Catch a Predator? I don't want to be on your creepy Facebook page, okay? This is really exciting. Thank you for polishing your head for the show, sir. You look fantastic. I got a haircut yesterday. It's a new style. It's called Give It a Couple Days. Did you get some good pictures, sir? Thank you. Look, I've been working out. Look at these abs right here. You're going to take a picture of that? You heard of washboard abs? I have smorgasbord abs. Wow. We should have had more security, huh? This is something else. You doing okay, sir? Are you here for the show or for the air conditioning? Is everything cool? Who dressed you, FEMA? Thanks for sitting in the front row. Do you mind putting your legs together? Is that cool? This is one of my first book events. I'm new at this. This is very cool. I wrote a book. It's about roasting. It's about all of us. We all have an inner roast master. Some of us have the good sense not to say these things out loud. But a roast master defies human nature. We say crazy, fucked up shit to people's faces. And it helps to know a little bit of karate. I'm very excited my book was named to Oprah's official book club selection today. Thank you very much. Yeah. She saw roasting. She thought it was a cookbook. She wrote me a lovely letter. Dear Jeff, not only was your book hilarious, it was delicious. That's what you call a cheap laugh. I'm usually better than that. We got a couple yeshiva students coming in late. Come on in. Guy just backpacked here from Haifa. If we could leave the lights on to make this as uncomfortable as possible for people, that'd be great. All right. Well, we're getting warmed up. This is kind of cool. I feel like, how about a hand for the band doing a great job? It's a great, great theater. Thomas Jefferson was bar mitzvahed in this room. Ben Franklin, who invented the curtain. I'm so hungry I could fuck a cheesesteak right now. No, it's all good. I'm kind of like, this is pretty like a thrill for me. You know, you work a year on something and then suddenly it just comes out into the world, and I'm sort of taking it all in a little bit. I went to Barnes & Noble yesterday, and I don't know, I was so excited to see my book on a bookshelf, and I walked in and I saw new nonfiction, and I didn't see it right away, and I was very excited. I'm looking around. I still didn't see it. So I said to the salesman, you know, where's the Jeff Ross book? It's called I Only Roast the One. And he sort of recognized me, and he goes, oh, come here. And he took me around to the back of the new nonfiction thing. There was a shelf underneath it that was blocked by a Curious George DVD display. And he pushed it out of the way. And he told me that if I signed the 12 books that they had there, they would move it into the window. So I signed the 12 books, and I saw Lisa Lampanelli's book, which had come out the same day, which is also about roasting. And I took it, and I went to the cashier. I was curious. And I got to the cashier, and I gave her my credit card, and she said, do you have any ID? So come on in, folks. Everybody was coming up here and saying a little bit about themselves. And you guys are up next. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Here comes a young couple who's just fucking in the men's room. How you doing, guys? I'm Jeff. No, it's totally cool. How's it going, you guys? How you doing, young man? How old are you? 13. Holy shit. This is not... You're going to read a book about... You don't even have pubic hair yet. Come up here for a second. Do you mind coming up here for a second? How's it going, man?
Good.
I'm Jeff.
Nice to meet you. I'm Ethan.
Ethan?
When's your bar mitzvah?
I'm not Jewish.
Oh, really? And you look awful. He's a good kid. He could take it, right? Who are you here with tonight?
My mom.
Wow. Where'd you guys meet? What made you come here tonight?
My grandfather gave us tickets, so I figured we might as well not waste them.
I think you got me on that one. That's awesome. What do you, have you read the book that have you ever seen? No? This is all new? Have you ever heard the joke, I wouldn't fuck you with B. Arthur's dick?
Not lately, no.
I just want to get it all out there early on and let it happen. You're a good guy, Ethan. You're a good sport. Thank you for coming up here. 13 years old. I do think roasting is good for adolescents because, you know, it teaches them respect and, I feel like it's like the same stuff you hear in the schoolyard, but with a little bit of rules and, you know, a hug at the end, right? I don't know. I was hoping to read one of my favorite parts of the book. I've never done this before, but I don't know. Has anybody here gotten to... I guess you all got it just now, right? So it won't be boring if I read part of the book? No, okay. That's what we're here for, right? It's about the book. I was going to read the photo credits on page 298. All illustrations by Saab Tondervano. Page 8, photo courtesy of Justin Barucci. Oh, all right, maybe that's not the most fun part. All right. Presented by Friends of the Free Library in... Oh, that's the podium. Never mind. This is a chapter on the history of the roast. I felt like most books about roasting are history books. You hear about what it was like in the days of Milton Berle and Buddy Hackett and We can talk about that stuff later. Obviously, those are the Mount Rushmore of roasting. And I love those guys. And but the one question I would always get was, you know, how did the roast start? Was it the Friars Club, or did that happen even before? Where did roasting start? So one of the first chapters in the book is the origins of the roast. So I'll read that. I'm wearing Andy's glasses. Okay. Human beings, can you hear me all right? Human beings have been busting one another's balls ever since we grew sacks. Early attempts at edgy humor took many forms, from the prosaic to the artistic. Evidence of prehistoric insult comedy is being unearthed as we speak. Someday soon, I hope a tape of Don Rickles roasting Frank Sinatra will surface and claim its rightful place in the Museum of Natural History. Beside a North African cave drawing of a limp-wristed Homo erectus fucking a triceratops in the Tuchus, where it belongs. A growing minority of biblical scholars believe that the first use of insults in a formal deist-type setting occurred at the Last Supper. Experts believe John the Baptist stood up shortly after dessert and started making fun of Jesus' outfit. Hey, JC, thanks for dressing up for the occasion. Seriously, nice flip-flops. I wish I kept everything I made in summer camp. However, it wasn't until the year 1783 that a great American patriot named Emanuel J. Rostenberg conceived and organized the first formal insult-themed testimonial dinner. His client and childhood friend, General George Washington, was about to be sworn in as the young nation's first leader, and Rostenberg thought it might be fun to honor his wooden-toothed compatriot by dishonoring him in front of Virginia's landed gentry. Rostenberg decided to call the night an evening of unkind words in tribute to our dear chum, with ticket proceeds going to scurvy research. Over cigars at Washington's Mount Vernon estate, Rostenberg explained that the evening would be a, quote, fair and egalitarian exercise in wit and bawdiness. With great passion, he further reasoned that if a war hero and first president was willing to endure such a verbal lashing, it would not only add to Washington's already immense popularity, but prove irrefutably to all citizens that they were finally free to criticize their leaders without fear of persecution. The right of the people to bear arms and hurl insults shall not be infringed. Fuck King George. Let freedom zing, Rostenberg famously proclaimed. Although Rostenberg was an eminent figure in colonial life, his origins are shrouded in mystery. Some historians think he was descended from a family of Prussian Jews who catered the first Thanksgiving. Another theory posits that his great-grandfather provided comedic entertainment on the Mayflower and bombed so badly that he was thrown overboard. One contemporary writing anonymously in a legal pamphlet dating from 1779 describes Rostenberg as, quote, an irrepressibly saucy and ebullient attorney, blessed by the Lord with a sagacious wit. This is old English language, which has the power to illuminate truth even as it offends gentle hearts, while another observer calls him simply, quote, an asshole. Rostenberg was renowned for his ability to demolish friend and foe alike with a pithy, perfectly timed bon mot, which made him a formidable opponent in the courtroom. Look at this jury. What is this, a trial by ugly? You get it? It's a lawyer in the 17th. All right. Some say that Rostenberg employed an indentured Irish servant to write jokes, while other accounts say he even owned a gag-writing slave. We do know for sure that invitations went out soon after General Washington agreed to participate. Rostenberg commissioned a local carpenter to build two long, narrow tables, quote, long enough for 10 men of considerable girth to sit side by side without knocking knickers. Between the two tables, Rostenberg placed a preacher's pulpit borrowed from a local church, so the invited speakers would have a place to rest their notes and libations. According to a brief report in the Virginia Gazetteer, the event was a rowdy and raucous affair that lasted well into the night.
legendary brewer Sam Adams was the first to speak. It's no secret that leading the revolution has given our friend Georgie a bulgy ego. Yes, that's right, bulgy, like Ben Franklin's tits or Betsy Ross's clitoris. Or your liver, yelled out John Hancock, the thunderous laughter. Betsy Ross herself leapt out of her chair to reveal a skimpy outfit she had made. Oh, you're just jealous, Mr. Adams. If memory serves, your extremities are small and bent, like the colony of New Jersey. I do, however, apologize for my scandalous attire. I just came from the Boston TNA party. General Georgie likes to salivate at the sight of my ample bosoms anyway, and I call that masturbation without representation. America's Seamstress was a surprise hit, but it wasn't until Emanuel J. Rosenberg himself took the pulpit that the show reached full gallop. Dearest Lord, I never saw so many bigwigs wearing bad wigs. I see Thomas Jefferson is here. Is this a benefit for scurvy or jungle fever? Seriously, Tom, we should party later. I hear it's singles night on the Amistad. Ben Franklin, thanks for polishing your scalp for the big show tonight. Poor guy invented electricity, bifocals, and the fire department, and he still can't get laid. He should have invented the toupee, because that's about as close as he'd ever come to giving a beaver head. After ribbing everyone in the room, Rosenberg finally focused his attention on the guest of honor. Quote, George's wife Martha wanted to be here, but she's having a splinter removed from her pussy. You didn't give her crabs, George. You gave her termites. Folks, I've known George since he was a kid, and I think the real reason he chopped down that cherry tree was because it had more of a personality than he does. As for Washington, the normally stoic general took the jokes in stride, claiming it was all for a good cause. Indeed, Rosenberg's An Evening of Unkind Words in tribute to our dear chum raised more than $32 for scurvy. Despite a minor protest from the Federation of Colonial Censors, FCC, Rosenberg's bold experiment was a rousing success. The historical significance of this night became evident a short time later during Washington's inaugural address, in which he called for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing free speech to all Americans. Most scholars agree that it's difficult to imagine a more influential event in our nation's history than Rosenberg's roasting of his dear friend and the father of our country. Any questions about Rosenberg? Yes, sir.
Was Bea Arthur there?
She was there. And rumor has it, and this has never been confirmed, but apparently Sam Adams, she held Sam Adams down while Ben Franklin fucked her from behind. I'm sorry, Ethan. You're just going to have to hear these things. It's not that I'm intentionally blue or dirty. It's just that roasting has traditions in blue language. I mean, the first time I ever went to a roast, Milton Berle was the roast master, and many people knew Milton Berle as a primetime television star. But I knew him as an 80-year-old man who loved to say cunt. It might be shocking when I say it, but when this old man said it out of his half of his corner of his mouth with a cigar hanging out, it was hilarious. The first time he ever introduced me, he said, please welcome a comedian who recently performed at a convention for lesbians with dildo rash. It was almost like a way the Friars Club and these roasts for comedians who normally have to go on primetime shows. I mean, I know what it's like going on The View or Dancing with the Stars where you have to keep it clean. But these guys needed an outlet for their bawdy, ridiculous personalities. So the Friars Club, I feel like, is a tradition, and the roasts, if they weren't blue, I don't know, I think they'd probably be boring. Yes, B. Arthur was there. Yes, sir.
Do you have a version of the aristocrats?
Oh, man. What's that? Yeah, I know.
I don't think this kid can handle it. I know. It's a joke about a young boy about 13 who defecates into his mother's vagina. It's awful, awful. And I feel like Gilbert Gottfried sort of, well, it's just that when somebody, you wouldn't ask, you know, another guitar player to play Layla, you know, other than Eric Clapton. Gilbert Gottfried, and it's in the book, I outline a chapter about the Hugh Hefner roast, which took place shortly after 9/11. I was a producer of the event, and we had to decide the weekend after 9/11 whether the roast goes on or not. And I tell the story in the book about Jean-Pierre Tribeau, the very refined executive director of the New York Friars Club, calling me up, and we didn't know really know how to handle this. You know, there's very little precedent for such a situation. You know, we're in New York. We're going to be roasting Hugh Hefner, the reason the terrorists hate us the most. Do we get our deposit back from the Hilton and tell everybody to go home, or do we figure this out? And we had to figure it out very quickly because all these places require a lot of preparation. And the roast was supposed to take place 3 weeks after 9/11. I called Buddy Hackett, as I normally would do in those situations. And I said, Buddy, what happened when John F. Kennedy was shot? You know, what happened to Las Vegas at that time? Were you? And he said he was working in Vegas when it happened. And it was very... it was obviously very sad, but he was walking around the hotel for a day and a half, then 2 days, and he just saw these tourists who had worked all year to go on vacation to Las Vegas. It wasn't like now where you get a shuttle flight here and there and there's all kinds of deals. It was a big, big vacation. And it was a couple of days later, and he decided, I think by the third night, that the show had to go on. And he told me that he waddled out on stage at the casino, and he said, a lot of you have, we've all lost a president. I've lost a president and a friend, and may God look after him. And then I went on with my show. That's what he said. So it struck me that, you know, it didn't have to be our typical roast. I sort of pitched it out to Comedy Central and the Friars Club and Mr. Hefner that we would do away with the after party, and we would make it a benefit, and... we wound up raising $500,000 for the Twin Towers Fund. And, you know, with Viagra jokes, it was, and, you know, Jimmy Kimmel was the roast master, which it's always a tricky thing to set the tone anyway. But Jimmy had to go and set this sort of new post 9/11 comedy show tone. We're wearing tuxedos. Hess there with seven blonde matching girlfriends. Yeah. The joke I said was, eight would be ostentatious. I said, Hef has seven girlfriends, one to put it in and the other six to move them around. And he was in a tuxedo. He took it very seriously, and no bathrobe at that one, but... he was really cute about it. He seemed to be really having a good time. I think he understood how relevant him showing up with his, you know, girlfriends and, you know, enduring while the Twin Towers is smoldering 3 miles downtown. We're up here doing this ridiculous show. And I remember, Rob Schneider was one of the first speakers. And you know him from Saturday Night Live. He's a funny guy, and he did a few jokes. He was doing very well. And then suddenly he did a few in a row that didn't really work. And now here I am, one of the producers, going, this is going to go in the toilet. What happens if this show just takes a morbid or uncomfortable angle? And I didn't know what to do, and it was this weird sort of dynamic. And I ran up to the podium, and I put my arm around Rob Schneider, and I said into the microphone, Rob, hasn't there been enough bombing in this city? And it was the first reference to what had happened. It's not that it's the greatest joke, but it was the first time anyone had addressed it. And I felt sort of a little bit of a tension release in the room, and everybody kind of got on a roll after that. I remember Artie Lang went on. He said, Hef, I smell pussy. Did you burp? And everybody went on. It was a really great show. It was an awesome roast. And then Gilbert Gottfried went on. And this is documented in the film The Aristocrats that the person mentioned. And I also tell my version of what Gilbert did and what Gilbert was going through in the book. Gilbert, if you're a Gilbert fan, you understand this. He has something in his head that no shrink at Bellevue could ever figure out, where he feels a need, a passion almost, to go too far. You know, we almost need Gilbert Gottfried so people know where the line is. Otherwise, there's no line, and no one really knows what's too far. So Gilbert goes up, and he does his jokes, and he's doing fine, you know. You know, he does a joke about how Hef is so old, he doesn't need Viagra, he needs a splint and tape. You know, he had a bunch of really funny jokes, and then for whatever reason, Gilbert has this thing where he just goes one more, and he said, I gotta get out of here soon, my flight leaves in a little while, and we have a connection at the Empire State Building. Exactly, so somebody in the back, way in the back, yells, too soon, too soon, and Gilbert starts doing this. You know, one reporter in the New York Observer described it as Gilbert channeling the podium as if it was a time machine that could go back 30 seconds into his show. And Gilbert didn't talk for a full minute, and he got heckled too soon, and Gilbert got very uncomfortable, and he just starts fishing. You can see his head working, but he doesn't know where to go, and he doesn't want to speak until he knows what to do. And like some sort of odd, you know, metamorphosis, he goes into the most vulgar joke in the history of show business. He tells the Aristocrats joke, which is basically, I won't tell the joke, but unless you don't know this, he says it's essentially a joke that comedians know and do. It has a beginning and an end, and then you fill in the middle, you know, your style. So Gilbert tells a joke about a family walking into a talent agent's office, and he says, talent agent says, what do you do? And he says, well, we're a family act. And, all right, tell us about it. And Gilbert, for 15 solid minutes, does every bestiality, fucking, sucking, you know, dogs, cats, donkeys, shitting, pissing, vomiting on each other, fucking each other. This is a family of four, by the way, we're talking about. And the mother does this, and the son does this, and the daughter does this, and the father. And it's just at a point where I remember not looking up for a full 5 minutes, part laughing, part crying. There's this weird, I don't know. I remember peeking up through my fingers, and I see Rob Schneider fall out of his chair. Literally, he just was in the front. He just fell onto the floor and was rolling around like a little kid watching a cartoon. Like, you know, something else happened. It wasn't 9/11 anymore. It wasn't anything. It was just, we were in this comedy wonderland. The audience, it was about 1,500 people. You felt a sense of relief, you know. It was almost like a muscle relaxer, like going to the, like to get a massage or something. You felt a certain tension in all our bodies just sort of happen. And Gilbert did his classic, you know, and then, you know, and then the talent agent says, that's an interesting act. What do you call yourselves? The Aristocrats. And he did his classic vaudeville bow. You know, he was wearing a white waiter's jacket, you know, for no real reason. And it was one of those things where, you know, you have two drinks and you leave and you go, oh, Gilbert, he was so funny. Man, that was really funny. And it's not until we left and we started to read press accounts and exactly remembering all the crazy stuff that happened. And Gilbert's performance went down in history. So whatever it is they wind up building in that giant retail complex that is the World Trade Center, maybe they'll put a comedy club in there in Gilbert's honor. I don't know. What do you guys want to do now? Yes. A favorite joke? That's a good question. Well, of mine or of anybody? I always go to Rodney Dangerfield in those situations because he's one of those comedians who I didn't get to know, but whenever you say favorite, the favorite joke, it's almost like it's not as jokes. Like if I'm feeling down or depressed or just need a little pick-me-up, I just hit Rodney Dangerfield on YouTube, and whatever comes up, his voice is my favorite thing to hear. It's like hearing, you know, the Beatles to me or something. His miserable intonation. Hey, hey, you know, my wife, at my house, my wife's such a bad cook, we pray after we eat. And, you know, it's almost like somewhere between Henny Youngman and, I don't know, there's something about, listening to Rodney's voice that is my favorite joke, so to speak. But I don't know if I can never remember jokes. I'm one of those people who I can, you get me on a roll, I can start telling a story. I have like 10 jokes in my act, and that's all I can really remember. But I don't know. Stu, do we have a favorite joke? Do I have a favorite joke?
I don't know. I mean, I was going to tell.
Which one? I'll back that up as my favorite joke. David Tell's joke. David Tell has a joke about, I got a postcard from my grandfather. It said, "Wish you were here. Where am I?" I always like the economical jokes. The least words for the biggest laugh is my favorite sort of formula. You'll notice in the book I take real careful, you know, I almost wish the one-liners could be in boldface because I look at them as poetry, even if they're not mine when I'm quoting people. I always find that the least words, for some reason, is the most fun jokes to hear and to read and to remember. And in the book, I give my secrets for writing roast jokes. Maybe I'll read a couple. That's a quick thing. The whole thing is, to me, is young people need to learn about roasting. Otherwise, it's going to become this lost art like jousting or journalism. Let me see if I can find this. Hold on. My secrets for writing roast jokes. Thinking up mean things to say is easy, but making them funny is a mysterious craft with no set rules. I wish there were a delicious smoothie full of creative juices that I could drink every morning, but the truth is sometimes you just have to stare into space until an idea pops into your brain. I once heard the comedian Paul Reiser describe joke writing as staring at the faucet waiting for the leak. Personally, I believe it's dangerous to examine too closely how the human nervous system creates these sparks of vitriolic insouciance. In fact, usually analyzing comedy gives me a headache. But for you people, I'm willing to pop a couple of Advil and deconstruct my process. Basically, I see funny insults as a combination of wit, timing, and animosity. Sometimes a great joke just drops from the sky and lands on my head like bird shit. Other times I have to bang my head against the wall just to come up with an okay joke. Sometimes a shitty joke and a great joke pop into my head all at once. Then my Aunt Donna calls and I forget both of them. Here's a few of my secrets to help you get started on your joke writing journey. Openers. Your first few jokes should try to encapsulate the event. There's no better way to win over an audience than by sizing up the entire dais in a single sentence. Congratulations, Carla. Are these your bridesmaids or the winners of an Octomom lookalike contest? Hey, Pete, how'd you get all these high-class folks to show up for your birthday? Was the Waffle House closed for renovations? For practice, look around right now and see if you can think up a single line that epitomizes your surroundings. If the room is full of nobodies, and let's face it, it probably will be, you might say, this isn't a who's who, this isn't a who gives a shit. At the Hillbilly Heavy Roast for Larry the Cable Guy, I said, this is the first show I've been to where the stars brought their own trailers. At the nearly 100% chocolate roast of Emmett Smith, I said, this isn't a roast, it's a barbecue. at the Paisan-populated roast of Pat Cooper, I said, this isn't a roast, it's a grease fire. At the oddball-infested roast of Bob Saget, I said, look around. This is what happens when you book a dais off Craigslist. Twofers. It's especially fun to nail two people with one line. Hey, Uncle Joe, I don't know what stinks worse, your feet or Aunt Donna's cooking. At a roast for the Today Show, Matt Lauer, I devised a killer twofer around his fluffy interviewing style. Let's face it, Matt's questions are softer than Neil Simon's cock. Trust me, insulting two birds with one stone won't diminish the impact of the joke. It only doubles the laugh. In the above case, it actually tripled the laugh because as soon as I said it, a sexy blonde in the front row leaped out of her chair and said, Neil Simon's cock works just fine. I should know, I'm his wife. That's a true story, and you can ask Neil Simon's wife about that when you see her. Crossbreeders. These are some of the most fun jokes to write. All you really have to do is stare at a picture of the person you're roasting and imagine how such a creature was created. Let your imagination run wild. Drew Carey, you look like Buddy Holly and Barney Rubble had a baby and then peed on it. Gene Simmons, you look like a rabbi fucked an Indian chief. Uncle Murray, you look like great-grandma Rosie was raped by an owl. That's just wrong. For practice, look at yourself in the mirror. That's what I do. Clearly, I look like Rick Moranis and Walter Matthau had a baby. And then punched it in the face. Does this sound better? Tags. A tag is a little joke that goes after a big joke. For example, if the joke is, Larry the Cable Guy has fucked so many farm animals, down south they call him Larry the Stable Guy, then the tag is, remember Larry, nay means nay. Another example, at the roast for sitcom dad turned perverted comic Bob Saget, I said, you may not know Bob used to give Mary Kate acting lessons. He'd say, shh, act like this never happened. Then I dropped a tag, which was a play on the Olsen twins' catchphrase from the show. She'd be like, you got it, dude. By tagging your jokes, you can use a single setup to get multiple laughs. This is the key to killing. Savers. One of the great challenges of performing a roast is that you are trying out material for the first time. Chances are some of these jokes will crash and burn. That's when you tell a, quote, saver, such as, hey, I don't even do comedy. I'm here to put up the chairs after you people leave. Some of my most dependable savers are, give me a break, folks. My writers are on strike. Well, I guess it's never too late for me to apply to law school. Good thing my dad owns this place. If I happen to make a joke about somebody who isn't there and it gets a groan, I always save it by saying, is he here? No? Then fuck him. The concept of a saver was first explained to me over chicken salad sandwiches at the Friars Club by the great roast master Milton Berle, who had perhaps the most reliable one ever. When one of his roast jokes bombed, he'd nonchalantly flip to his next index card and say, here's another one you may not care for. Keep your distance. For harsher jokes, you may want to distance yourself slightly from the comedic accusation. The goal here is to deflect responsibility. In other words, say that you're not really saying what you're saying. I'm not saying her ass is big, but when she shakes it, the tides change. I'm not saying her cooking is bad, but I think my vomit speaks for itself. Creating this slight buffer zone between you and the joke will help you dish out the hard stuff without being overly offensive. Playing dumb. The trick here is to say something horrible in the form of an innocent question. Tony, clear something up for me. Is that a very bad toupee or a very sick ferret? Nice blouse, Laura. Where'd you get it? Forever 41? Is she here? Hey, Uncle Herman, are those your teeth or did you crash your Chrysler into a piano store? In roasts, as in life, playing dumb will help you get away with a lot. Some of you don't even have to play. Closers. Your closer should not only be your strongest joke, but should also express a sentiment that sums up the overall message of your roast. Ideally, it should be a backhanded compliment. At the Larry the Cable Guy roast, I close by saying, ladies and gentlemen, ask not what your country can get or done for you. Ask how this inbred cousin fucker made $28 million last year. However, the bigger the build-up your closer has, the better. At the Bob Saget roast, I finish by paying tribute to the guest of honor's love of expletives. Folks, you may have noticed I didn't curse at all tonight because I didn't want to compete with the master. Out of all the comics I know, Bob, you've got the filthiest mouth and the kindest heart, and there's no way I could ever top you. But in honor of the late, great George Carlin, I do want to leave you all with another 7 words you will never hear on television. And the Emmy goes to Bob Saget. With a closer like that, there's nothing left to do but take a bow and let the next person try to follow you. As they say in the roast business, always leave them wanting more. Props. If you're afraid of speaking in public, don't worry. You can still be a roaster. Using props allows you to talk less and let the jokes speak for themselves. Even yours truly, a guy who failed shop class 3 times, has a love for prop building. In fact, I was the one who told Carrot Top to attach a tiny key to a large black dildo and say that he found Lisa Lampanelli's car keys backstage. Prop comics may not have to talk the talk, but they do have to top the top. Costumes. I'm a very strong believer in artistic expression through wardrobe. Try dressing up as your guest of honor's priest, mom, or parole officer. The goal is to make your outfit part of your act. A minute into my roasting of Larry the Cable Guy, I ripped the arms off my tuxedo as an homage to the Gitter Dunn Guy's signature sleeveless style and yelled, Gitter Roasted. At Carson Daly's Rock and Roll Bash on MTV, I came out in a giant pink furry phallus costume and performed as Carson Daly's dick. My opening joke was, look how relieved Kid Rock is for once he's not the biggest dick in the room. At Pam Anderson's roast, a few people booed when I walked in wearing a fur coat. I feigned confusion. What? This is a benefit for PETA, right? People who eat and torture animals? I tagged it up with, don't worry, it's not real. We just shaved B. Arthur's back. The last example is interesting because not only is it a tag, it's also a twofer. Even though the joke was set to Pam Anderson, it was really about B. Arthur. Once you start turning your tags into twofers, then you have truly mastered the mysterious craft of writing roast jokes. Any questions about that? Oh, thank you. This is so fun. I think I have time for a couple more questions, and then I'm going to sign books to anybody who wants to. Creepy guy in the front.
Was Chevy Chase hard to work with?
I never worked with Chevy Chase. Interestingly enough, after the Hef roast in 2001, I had a little bit of a, I don't know. They asked Chevy Chase to be roasted, and I didn't know Chevy Chase, and for me, it's very real when I say I only roast the ones I love. I have to either be a friend or a big fan. I think Chevy Chase is funny, but I didn't think he'd be a good sport. I didn't really feel like that was, I don't know. I just wasn't feeling it, and I didn't do it. And then everybody says it was like the worst roast ever. So what's the lesson there? You better fucking book me at your roast. Sure, right there. Yes, I've been reading Lisa's book. She does a great account of the time she fucked that black guy. I have been enjoying Lisa's book. And I was on a local New York TV today promoting my book, and they had her pop in via satellite and bust my balls. It was really awesome. You know, there's a lot of, you know, it seems like we're competitive. Greg Giraldo, Nick DiPaolo, Lisa, all the roasters. But the truth is, like, great roasts are the extensions of great friendships. And the more protected we feel, the more rat packy it feels up there, the better the show is and the more fun we have. So, I definitely will read Lisa's book. And she better not say any mean shit about me in it. Yes, sir.
Did you ever Well,
the one that, there's a couple ways. When I was first doing it, I didn't really know the rules. I didn't really have, you know, my own philosophies on it. And I would make fun of occasionally people who weren't there. I would work them in just because I had a good joke. I was roasting Rob Reiner, great director. And I said, I don't know how to do this. I mean, how do you embarrass a guy who married Penny Marshall? What was your wedding song? How much is that doggy in the window? He laughed, but a couple of months later, I'm at another roast. I'm in Las Vegas roasting the owners of the Palm Casinos, the Maloof brothers. And there's Penny Marshall right in the front, completely whacked out of her mind. And they introduce me to the podium, and she starts shouting me down like that guy did to Obama in the Senate the other day. And, you know, it was really uncomfortable, and she started, like, slowly making her way towards the stage. And I had worked weeks on my jokes about these guys who I was friends with, and I wanted to not be interrupted by her and not deal with her trying to explain. He said stuff about me. Then the audience, their focus was completely pulled, and it just seemed awful. And it's Penny Marshall, so they're all like, what is going on here? And as she got closer and closer, I could tell she was huffing. She was going to make a big speech about me, and I was terrified. And she got about 15 feet away, and I said, which one were you again, Lenny or Squiggy? And she sat back down, and I was not invited to the after party. So I learned there that you have to sort of be careful about roasting, you know. Another thing Buddy Hackett would always talk about is he would never want to do prank shows and hidden camera shows. You know, it was always about if you're going to make fun of people, you do it to their face. And I've sort of tried to stick to that. And nowadays I try to roast volunteers. It works out better. Yes, ma'am. Right. Were you there? What do you mean loved it at the time? Well, I mean, I think it was a private event. Back then, this was 1994. If you don't know the story, the Friars Club in New York. This is a year before they asked me to do a roast. So I only hear, you know, legend of this night, of this afternoon. But Whoopi Goldberg was being roasted, and her boyfriend for years at that point was Ted Danson. Two very funny people, two very sophisticated comedic minds. They wanted to push it, you know? So they get Ted Danson came out in blackface. And Whoopi Goldberg, it was her idea. She wrote his jokes. I've asked Whoopi about this. And she was totally thinking that this would just be a really fun, ridiculous thing. And Montel Williams, exactly, who gives a shit, got up out of his chair, off the dais, stomping away, went right to the newspapers. He had a talk show that had just gone into production. He was looking to get some heat. And he said, I'm offended as a black man, and this and that, and this and that. And Whoopi was, you know, very few people came to her defense. It was a time of extreme political correctness. And it made it hard for a while. The Friars then I think suffered from it, and the roast sort of suffered from it because, you know, it was just a sticky time. And it wasn't, in a way, I sort of benefited because then 1995 rolled around and they couldn't get anybody to do the roast. So then they called up some fucking idiot from Greenwich Village and was like, do you want to roast Steven Seagal? And I was like, what's a roast and who's Steven Seagal? I kind of knew what it was, the roasting thing, but I jumped at it. I said, you sure? And this is pre-YouTube, pre-Google. I had to go to the Museum of Broadcasting and look up to see what the heck this was and what the parameters were and how does it work? Are you dirty? Are you clean? Are you short and long? I didn't know what it was. And I got a little taste for it, and it was very exciting. They sent a car for me to pick me up. It's going to be at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, noon, a lunch, you know, 1,000 people at the New York Hilton, and I had my one good suit, and I'm backstage, and suddenly I'm shaking hands with Buddy Hackett and Henny Youngman and Milton Berle, and there's all these other, like, you know, great New York sort of literary figures mulling around, and the politicians, the David Dinkins. It was just blowing my mind that I was in the same room with people who made a living, let alone were the creme de la creme of New York. And even if it was just going to be for 2 hours, I was rolling with these heavyweights and the legends of comedy. It was remarkable. And I'm nervous wreck. I'm fidgeting with my notes. And Henny goes on and Buddy goes on. And finally they get to me. And Milton gives me that introduction that I told you before. And I was really nervous. And Steven Seagal was sitting right here. And I got up to the podium. And I look at Steven Seagal and I said, I realize a lot of you don't know me, but I feel uniquely qualified to be here today because I'm also a shitty actor. And it was like, you know, home run. And I did a few more jokes and I was on a roll, you know, like I'd worked hard on this material and tried it out on my friends and, you know, a couple clunkers. You're doing material for the first time. But I had a bunch of really good ones about his movie, Under Siege 2, being released in the theaters like nerve gas or something. And as I'm on a roll, every time I get a big laugh, I feel a bump. Milton Berle is the roastmaster sitting here. There's a podium and a table, so no one sees this. His fingers were like this long, and he had long nails. And every time I got a big laugh, he went, bam, right in my ribs. So I would do this on the punchlines. He knew right away what jokes were going to work, and he felt it. Boom. And it was very unusual. At first, I don't know if he wants me to get off. I don't know if I should ignore him. I don't know if he's fucking with me. I don't know what this is. They didn't give me any tickets to my friends. I'm completely alone at this, you know, very, and, you know, finally I'm like, I got like another page of jokes and the audience must think I have some sort of Tourette's or something or a tic. And finally I just engaged him. I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you poking me? And I said, you never know what you're going to see in New York. I was walking around down today. I saw Uncle Milton in an antique shop. $800. And he picked it up from there. Then he started getting me, and I started getting him. And, you know, it wasn't brilliant, but I was holding my own. And, you know, you just sort of rise to the occasion. You're suddenly on a tennis court with John McEnroe. It's just, you're there, you're doing it. And he just won't leave me alone, and I'm trying to get to my jokes. I'm trying not to seem flustered, and I'm keeping my cool, but it's obviously affecting my performance, and he's obviously going to win. He's Milton Berle. It's the Friars Club. He's done 100 roasts. Finally, out of nowhere, I hear this voice off mic from way down the end of the dais. It's Buddy Hackett, who I'd only just met, and he says, you know, out of the side of his mouth, the way he used to talk, "Hey, Milton! Let the kid work. Remember when you used to?" And Milton runs all the way down to the end of the dais, and he kisses Buddy on the lips. And I don't know, I'm just swinging for the fences. I said, give him a round of applause between the two of them. They have over 80 years of homosexual experience. And I wrapped it up, and Milton Berle came over, and there's a picture of it in the book that I'm very proud of. He gives me a big, wet one right on the cheek in front of everybody, gave me a hug, and I sat down. It was like being in my Yankee Stadium for the first time. I couldn't believe this was happening. I went back to the Friars Club, you know, and had a drink with Buddy, and that's a tradition. You go back to the club, and I asked Buddy, you know, I said, why was that Milton Berle? Why would he poke me like that? He said, that's what he does if you're funny. He said, he's been doing that forever. He goes crazy when other people get laughs. Take it as a compliment. And that gave me the confidence to go over to Milton. And I asked him for advice. I said, you know, that was really fun. Is there anything I could do if I do this again? And he said, he thought about it. He loved to, he loved to, you know, drop words of wisdom. And he said, do less jokes, do less time. They only remember the home runs. And I took that with me. You know, it's a really good thing. These roasts, you know, you just, the big ones, the big jokes are what people remember. You don't need to talk forever. And, you know, I missed that guy. His last roast, my first roast was his last roast. Interestingly enough, he lived another, you know, about 8 or 9 years, but he wasn't performing anymore. One of the last times I saw him was at Sid Caesar's 75th birthday party, and I'm on stage. They asked me to do my stand-up act, and I spot Milton in the audience, and he was in a wheelchair, and I said, give Milton Berle a round of applause, and I see he brought a wheelchair for his dick. Because he had this legendary, gigantic penis. And he leaped out of his wheelchair and he said, my dick is fine, this wheelchair is for my balls. those were the days. Yes, sir. Huh? Say it again. By the way, Al Franken, congratulations on being the senator from... Like Art Garfunkel and... I don't know. And Larry Fine had a baby, thank you. it's bad news when the ex-con in the fourth row is getting bigger laughs than me. Everything okay over there? All right. This is fun. I don't know. So, well, I'm sorry. You're asking me. I didn't mean to be a wise guy.
And my wife appreciates.
Sure. It is tricky. It is tricky because the last real legend, Sid Caesar, he's almost 90, and it's tricky because there's not that much stuff. There's a lot of really funny Catskills comedians, you know, Mousy Lawrence and Freddie Roman and Dick Capri and Stewie Stone. These guys are still working. I had lunch with Stewie and Freddie today at the Friars Club, and if you live in Palm Beach, Florida, you can see them this summer. You know, there's not that many places where it flies, and, you know, the world is getting smaller and smaller, and the niche of, that style of comedy is, this is what happens. There'll be a whole bunch of new old guys coming up. I'll be one of the new old guys really soon. One more? Should we take one more? Two more? Yes, sir. Right.
Obviously, it had to be easy for you because I was coming up with some of my own when I was sitting on the cast watching it. I thought I know it was easy for you, but what does she say after? What does she say after? And what did Tommy Lee have to say? I know that.
Well, Tommy Lee doesn't talk. He's...
He just looks at you and just gives a look, right?
No, he just whips his dick out and he pounds it on the table. Anybody who can honk a boat horn with his dick is my hero. But Pam Anderson, you have to realize that roast was, well, it was easy. You know, I said her vagina is so big, they give donkey rides down to the bottom. Yeah. I said, I'm not saying it's the size of a Lincoln Tunnel. I'm saying it's bigger. And, you know, you say, what did she say afterwards? She sent me roses. It was a benefit for PETA, for her charity. She made a ton of money. She was very, very grateful. She couldn't have been a better sport about the whole thing. She wore a see-through top. She let Andy Dick feel her boobs. She got her friends down there. It was also, you know, if we're going to be talking about roast history and the art of the roast, it was a turning point in the elevation of the popularity of the roast, because now suddenly roasting was no more dais. We were going to do couches, and it was going to be like somewhere between roasting and roller derby, because that was the infamous Courtney Love incident where Courtney Love was invited to be at this roast. And she went into the bathroom right before the roast with Andy Dick, which I repeat is never, ever a good idea. And she came out this maniac, this screaming lunatic that you saw on TV. She's humping the armrest. She's flashing her boobs. Jimmy Kimmel, the roast master, had to physically hold her into her seat so that the roasters could do their speeches uninterrupted. And the show is going on and on, and Courtney's getting worse and worse and worse. And I'm sitting there making notes, and I've worked weeks on my jokes. And I hadn't done a roast in a while. Remember, I stopped, you know, after that Heff roast. And now it's like 4 years, and I really want to make a big impression, but this crazy beast is going to interrupt me. And I sort of had it in my head. I wrote a joke in my margin. And I said, you know, if it's... And I showed it to Jimmy Kimmel during a commercial break, and he said, you cannot do that joke under any circumstances. Huh? Yeah, so it's like I had a certain sort of mission to roast her into rehab. She was completely off her rocker. I mean, there's pictures in the book. She's got her legs spread, and she's flashing and giving the finger. And it's a comedy show on Comedy Central, you know what I'm saying? And it was... I get up there, and I come out in the full-length fur coat, and I do those jokes, but Courtney Love starts throwing ice at me. And she's losing it. She's completely crazy. And I'm doing my jokes, and I see her start coming towards me, and I'm thinking this is a benefit for PETA. Maybe somebody has a stun gun or something. And I did one joke. I said, Courtney Love, you're like the girl next door if you happen to live next to a methadone clinic. And instead of shutting her up, she did, come on, bring it. And I did another joke about her. I thanked her. I said, let's all give her a round of applause for not singing tonight. And that pissed her off. And she starts coming at me. And she lunges for my notes. And this is well documented on the broadcast. And I grab my notes and I run over here. And, you know, it's a little bit of cat and mouse. And finally, I looked at the joke in my margin and I said, folks, how is it possible that Courtney Love looks worse than Kurt Cobain? Right, so it's the sound of 1,000 jaws dropping at once. Courtney Love immediately sobers up and checked herself the next morning into rehab. So roasting saves lives. Thank you. I think that's it. You ready to come back up? That was cool. Can I sign these books?
Yeah, we'll go upstairs.
That was really fun. You're an awesome crowd. Thank you for your questions and your laughs, and good luck.
It was great.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.